Ear deal, ha hey, 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 ear deal, ha hey.
Air breathe, air blow, make this wheel of magic go, work this wish for which we pray. Ear deal, ha hey,
ear deal, ha hey.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode, episode 3 of Magical Musings. Tonight we're dealing with divinity.
Water bubble, water boil, make this wheel of magic toil, work this wish for which we pray, ear deal ha hey ye.
And I want to remind folks that if you guys want to get a hold of Joy or myself outside of the show,
earth without, earth within, make this wheel of magic spin, work this wish for which we pray, ear deal ha hey ye.
My blog is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com, and Joy's is wide-worlds-joy.
Fire blaze, fire burn, make this wheel of magic turn, work this wish for which we pray, eo dio ha hey ye.
We gotta get that thing.
Yes, we do.
We gotta get that intro music tweaked. Yeah, I need to pull it down so that the actual chant part is a little bit quieter so that we can talk to you guys while it's playing and maybe sounds a little bit better.
Well, I mean, I can turn the volume down on it with the studio stuff, but we'll see.
I must have sent the wrong version to you. Anyway, hi, guys.
Hello. How are you, folks? Welcome back, Joy.
All right.
Brian,
we've
obviously
got... Yeah, we've got the chat room open, so if y'all want to join us and listen live on the website, we're at blogtalkradio.com/woodwoes/2013/10/18/magicalmusings. It's probably up there. As soon as you get to Woodwoes, you'll see that the show is in progress and you'll be able to join in. We'd love to hear from you guys. We exist on your feedback, and we've got a good show tonight, I think. Tonight we're going to be dealing with divinity, except that title's a little bit misleading. Actually, what we're going to be talking about is how to deal with not only the divinity in your life as a group, but as actual individual deities, but also any being that has, that does not have a body, that is in a, I guess you could call it an astral aspect, and that's really where this thrust is going to be. So that's going to include things like guardians and angels and thought forms and stuff like that. But most of this is going to be focused on deities and gods. Okay, we're going to do this because it seems to be one of the popular, I guess, misconceptions that because they're a god, they're infallible. And that's probably the last thing that they are. Most people that have been doing this for a while are laughing uproariously right now, so I'll let them finish because gods are not perfect. I mean, they really aren't. I think that's a misconception that came over from Christianity when a lot of people decided, oh, I'm not Christian anymore. I'm going to be pagan or Wiccan or whatever. The first thing you really have to understand about these is that these relationships are actually a relationship. Okay? It is not something that you sit down and you figure that, well, that's interesting. Brian just vanished from the chat room. Interesting. Okay. These are...
I don't know why. I would.
I see guests in there, and I see me. And, oh, well, anyway. They're relationships. It's a relationship like you would have with a sibling, like you would have with a parent, like you would have with a friend. Okay. Most people look at these interactions between you and the spirit as an inferior to a superior, meaning that the spirit is automatically better than you because they're spirit. And to a point, that's true. but not to the extent that a lot of people try to take it to. Okay, I work on the astral lots, practically every night, in fact. I've got four different places that I go to, see spirits all the time, talk to them, rule over some of them, control others, tell others what to do. I've got several thought forms that are out doing magic for me while I'm, you know, conscious and not directing them. They're pulling in information and things like that. And then there's the dealing with dragons. There's about 16 different dragons in my life for various reasons. And while I'm not necessarily dealing with them every night, they're enough of a presence that it seems like they're always in my face. So you can't start out with the mindset that you are a worm and that they are always better, okay, because that's going to hurt you overall. If you have a specific deity that you worship, that you interact with, that is your patron or matron deity, that's great, okay? Have them, hold them in reverence, give them the things that they ask for, talk to them, listen to them, pray to them. Everybody else that you interact with as a spirit, you got to treat them as their individual merits. If they come at you, you know, with information and they're willing to share it and they're willing to talk to you, great, do that. If they come at you hostily, demanding that you worship them, slap them upside the head, you know, whatever. But you have to work on these relationships, okay? They're exactly like a friendship. They're any other relationship you have in your life, either with a sibling or a parent or whatever. You have to work on that, okay? You can't just say, oh, hi, Mom, and then you never talk to her after birth. I mean, she, you know, she bore you, she's your mother. You've got to talk to her occasionally, and you've got to tell her what's going on and ask her things.
That's what Mother's Day is for.
Yeah. Okay, that's a whole nother rant that I could get into for several hours because I hate most modern holidays simply due to the fact that I don't need one special day to say that I love you more than I do on every other day. Because, you know, I just love you. So we're going to get off of that topic right now and move on.
All right.
It is a relationship. And it's very much one that you have to work at. But by the same token, the deity has to work at it too. All right. I said last episode, and I think I said it in the first episode as well, and it's up all over my websites. It's up on the main website we have, magicalmusings.net. And I'll say it probably next episode too, is prayers when you talk to the gods and meditations when you listen to them. And it's a two-way street. You do have to listen to them. Talking to the gods doesn't do any good if immediately after you get done telling them everything, you go, okay, bye, and you're gone, okay? It's the same thing as coming into the house after a hard day at school, core dumping all over your mom, and then grabbing her car keys, and you're out the door, okay? You have no time to listen to her. You have no time to absorb any of her advice. You have no time for her to even grunt and, you know, acknowledge that she heard you. And if you do that consistently, say, over the course of a year, you might start getting the impression that she doesn't care about you at all because she never responds to anything. Well, you're not giving her a chance to. You're not giving her time to say, well, have you tried this? Maybe they're feeling this way. Maybe they're doing that. Okay, so you do have to stop and listen occasionally. And meditations when you do that, typically – what I advise the people that I work with who are getting out onto the astral plane is, okay, you want to talk to the deities. Okay, so you get into a ritual or whatever. You kneel down by your bedside. You go sit in a sylvan glow grove or whatever, and you open up a prayer. you talk to your god and goddess, and then after you get done talking to them and asking for whatever and saying that they're great, wonderful, and marvelous, sit and be quiet for about 2 minutes at the end of it, before closing the prayer, before getting up and going on with whatever, okay? Because that's when you listen for responses. Recently, I wound up starting to watch Game of Thrones from HBO. And one of the episodes, it had a character that lived in the wilds her whole life, and she's talking to one of the other characters who just got done praying to a tree because it had a face and it's acknowledged as a one of the old gods, one of the spirit nature gods. And he did his prayer to the tree and then got up and started wandering off, and she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm done. She's like, but you're not giving them time to answer you. And so he sat down for a couple of minutes, and then she started saying, you hear that? Because it was birds tweeting. They're talking to you. And then you hear the wind through the leaves. And then you start smelling the grass. And all these are your deities communicating with you, talking to you, answering you, giving you thoughts and suggestions. And if this grass smell brings up a specific association in your brain, that's what it should do. That's why you smelled it. That's why suddenly you're feeling this way. Okay? And this is what is supposed to happen. So take a couple minutes. You know, it's not going to kill anything. Let's see. Something that you need to really understand is the deities that you're going to be encountering on the astral when you start taking up a pagan path, they're not caricatures, okay? You always hear about, well, let's pull this one. There's a cartoon that was on for a few years called Clash of the Titans. It was basically heroes and deities out of the ancient myths, Greek myths, who were reincarnated as teenagers. And these teenagers went around trying to fix things, okay? But they had deity characters in there, like Hephaestus, okay? And they made him pretty one-dimensional. I mean, you know, he's a cartoon character. He doesn't have a lot of depth to him. I guess they figured that people that were watching the cartoon either would know a little bit about mythology or would be interested enough to go and look him up. So they made him a hard drinker who smithed out weapons and stuff. Well, that's not all Hephaestus was about, okay? You got to remember he also had a club foot, and because of that he needed assistance in his forge, which is why he had the Cyclopses. And then, you know, with that assistance, he would have other things that were happening, you know, because here's a deity who has, who's, I'm going to say it, a cripple, even though he wasn't. He was disabled or differently abled or however you want to say it these days. And that person, what?
I'm just thinking how difficult it was to say that, because in the myths about Hephaestus, he's got a game leg. You know, he hobbles around on one good leg,
mm-hmm.
and we're okay with that because he's still Hephaestus.
Yeah, you know, and that's gonna change his personality. I mean, I'm sure that when they were growing up in wherever they started existing from, he got picked on by the other gods, you know. Oh, here's Hephaestus. He can't even walk across a room right. You know, he's limping all the time. He's probably in pain, so he probably understands that. He's probably going to be the patron of, let's say, people who are disabled, and that's going to be something that's going to add depth to his personality. So, you know, this isn't a one shot one-dimensional deity. This is somebody that is actually, you know, a person, which is what these deities are. They are people, ultimately. They have stories. They have backstories. They have things they like. They have things they dislike. I know the Dionysus, for another example. Everybody sees him as the hard-partying deity with the boots. Okay, and he's happy and he's jolly and he, you know, laughs and he's, you know, constantly saluting people and tossing back a drink and everything. But there's another nature there that you won't find until you start reading the mythology, because normal associations with him and normal just common knowledge has lost this. There's the mean drunk who gets violent, who yells and screams, who breaks things, who goes out and jumps in a car and does 90 down the street and wipes out a family of five and walks away from it, you know, and then it's like, well, they shouldn't have been in the street, you know. And that's another side of his nature. There's the morose drunk as well. The one that, you know, starts drinking and he starts sobbing at the end of the bar, and the more he drinks, the more he cries and the worse it is and the louder he gets and the, oh, how he hated her, but damn, he misses his dog and, you know, whatever. That's another part of him.
That's true. And I mean, you know, it's the same with any of the gods, really.
Yeah, and these are things you're not going to discover until you start looking into their myths, you know, and this is part of the homework for paganism, is looking into those myths and reading about them and reading about their natures and realizing that if you're going to worship a deity and a being, you're not just worshiping the common conception of that deity, okay? There are schools of thought that when you're dealing with a divinity, that instead of dealing with a person with a personality, instead of dealing with somebody that is out of a mythological set of stories, like Athena's stories or whatever, you're dealing with a conception, a thought form. The school of thought states that the gods started existing because we needed them to exist. Primitive man had a time when they were in outside and rain was coming down and they were going, oh, what is that? And it's hitting them in the face. And then suddenly the lightning flashed and the thunder boomed and they got scared and they ran into the holes that they lived in. Okay. But they didn't know what was causing this. They didn't know it was static electricity and that the sound was from the lightning rapidly heating and expanding and then collapsing the atmosphere, okay? So they made up a deity to explain that. Thor, with his hammer, throws it across the sky and the lightning comes off of it, and when it hits the giant, it goes boom, okay? Which is, you know, a very logical assessment. Okay. The thing is that once you have a deity of lightning and thunder, you start seeing the deity of lightning and thunder in every single pantheon and every single peoples. Okay. Just
very
like you
true.
See a god of death in every single people's grouping of gods. Okay. And so you start thinking that, okay, Raiden from Japanese mythology, the god of lightning, is the same as Thor, the god of lightning from Norse mythology, who is the same as Lu,
Zeus,
Samaldanich, or Zeus,
or him,
or, you know, whoever. And you start assuming that all these four deities, Raiden, Thor, Zeus, and Lu, are the same god, and that you can treat them the same. And if you know anything about these four divinities, you know, no, they are different people. And they would be highly insulted if you tried to treat Thor the same way you would treat Zeus and treat Lu the same way you treated Raiden. They're just not the same deity. Okay? So don't fall into that trap. Understand that the cultures that you're dealing with who have this divinity as part of their pantheon are going to shape the personality of the deity there. Even if it's the same aspect as another deity in another culture, the culture itself is going to change the spin, I guess, of that deity. And it's going to make them a different person. Okay?
Although,
go.
The question comes to mind then that, you know, listeners might have on their minds is, what about the Wiccan idea that all the gods are one god and all the goddesses are one goddess?
Okay.
You know, you've got, like, multiple names, you've got multiple personalities, you've got varying mythologies. What's your thought on that? Because, I mean...
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the real sticking points when you get to... When you start getting into it. My theory, and as far as I can tell, it's been borne out by several of the gods themselves, is that what the Wiccans are doing is breaking it down into a duality, a male deity and a female deity, okay? One of the easiest ways to explain it is that you have yin and you have yang. Okay, you have one deity, one galactic, cosmic, uber consciousness called the Is that is so out there and so remote and so unfathomable that we can't relate to it at all. So we don't worship that one. We know it's there. We know it's part of us that we're part of it. But it's like the bacteria, one bacteria in my gut trying to worship the person that is joy. Okay? It's on the same scale. You see so little of the puzzle that you can't relate to the overall consciousness in a way that makes sense. So in order for us to conceive of something that is everything, we break it out into a male and female part. Okay, in Judaism, it's Kether and Vash, I think, but it's some of the seraphim on the Tree of Life. And you have the very top circle, and then you have the two directly below it. That two, one's male, one's female, okay? And that's the god and goddess that most Wiccans are praying to, this generic concept of this is a female. This is the person that has all qualities of every female everywhere. This is a male deity. This is the god. This is the deity that has all the qualities of a male everywhere. And this is including such stuff as the female that eats her own young, like Serweden does. The female who stays at home and raises the children, and does the hearth fire, and takes care of the house, like Athena does. This is Kali Durga, who is a deity that is associated with killing hundreds of demons, and then drinking their blood and getting so drunk off of it that she starts this dance that would destroy creation if it continued. This is the female, the Morrigan, who goes out and kills and kills and kills and enjoys killing. And then at the same time picks who's going to die in battle. This is, you know, every single female deity and every single aspect of any female that you can possibly think of is encapsulated in this goddess. Okay. And that's where you get the goddess and the god that most Wiccans are talking about at that point. That's what they're actually trying to worship. Except even that conception is so out there that they can't wholly conceive of a deity that is a loving mother, a good wife, and at the same time kills her own children. Okay, so they start breaking it down into divinities with names and worshiping those divinities, because then they're more like us, and we can relate to what is like ourselves. And so as long as we can relate to something, we can understand that this female deity here is a goddess who doesn't take crap from anybody and who is an outstanding magician, we can relate to that. And so we start worshiping Eriandrod and calling on her in various things. But at the same token, because she is one part of a divine mosh pit, if you will, people make the mistake that she is the same as Athena or the same as Heavenly Mother in the Mormon theology, okay? And that's where things starts getting screwed around. Make sense?
It does.
Okay.
So I've lost my train of thought. Continue.
Oh, it's all right. I mean, all of this relates back to each other. Once again, we're talking about gods, we're talking about thought, and to me at least, it's much easier as a practitioner to get a patron or matron deity that I can relate to on a personal level, okay? It's like going out and picking my own mom and dad. They have qualities that I need to explore. They have intelligence that I haven't ever gotten or I haven't been exposed to, and part of their job is to teach me those things and to show me them and to expose me to them, okay?
Sorry, I was just going to ask where you stand on the combination of multiple pantheons, because I know lots of particular, I'm going to say particularly Wiccan folks that I know who combine pantheons in, say, coven rituals or what have you.
What, you mean like a Grecian goddess and a Celtic god?
That kind of thing.
Okay. I'm against it, mainly due to the fact that you've got to understand the cultural interactions, because once again, the deities are shaped by the culture that worships them. Okay, and it's great to have two deities of combat if you're doing a ritual to protect somebody in your personal coven work. Okay, but you've got to be really, really careful if you're going to call on Mars and then call the Morrigan at the same time. Okay, both of those are combat deities. One's male and one's female, but one's from Rome and one's from the Celts. And if you can remember the Gallic Wars, they were big enemies. So Mars,
yes,
and the Morrigan sitting in the same ritual is probably not going to be fun. They're probably going to spend more time fighting each other than they would listening to you ask them for favors. Okay,
so
you
got to
be
true.
Real careful. And 90% of the time, if you actually look into the cultural pantheon of one or the other, you're going to find somebody that is exactly what you're looking for from that culture. For instance, combat. In the Greek, you have Mars. Well, you also have Athena. She was a combative female. Okay. She had the Aegis shield. She was the counterbalance to Mars's insanity, berserker state, running around killing everything. She actually considered plans and thought about what she was doing and took steps to do it rather than just going nuts. If you look at the Celtic, you have the insane warrior queen, Xena, and you have somebody like Nuada of the Silver Hand, who was also a king, also combat-oriented, and he got crippled while in combat because he wasn't being mindful and being planful. You know, so you've got the same counterbalance there from the same culture. You don't have to use two dissimilar cultures. The only reason Wiccans tend to do that, and I'm going to say this and make this general pronouncement and probably get crucified for it, but it's because they're lazy. They know the name Mars. They know the name Morrigan. They know they're both warriors. Let's put them in the same ritual.
And speaking of comments, if you want to call into the show, you can call us at 646-564-9966. It's based out in New York. If you feel like calling us, so feel free if you want. Give Joy a piece of your mind.
Yeah, if you're listening to a recorded version of this, unfortunately, you're SOL. You have to be listening to it live, so then you can call me and read me the Riot Act and tell me how stupid I am. That's fine.
And if you want to email either of us, you can hit us up at brian or joy@magicalmusings.net. One word, magical musings, no K in the magical. And it's .net. Yeah.
Yep.
We love having interaction with our listeners, so feel free to hit us up, comment, criticize, whatever you feel like.
Yeah. Yes, we do. I actually, one of the things that I wind up doing is asking how many people we had listening to the show and how many people downloaded it and stuff, and it's actually getting kind of impressive numbers so far for just word of mouth. We had, nearly 200 people last week listened and downloaded the show. And, you know, from, 6 months ago, the final episode of Tarot Talk pulled down 2,000. So, you know, getting a tenth of the listenership in 1 week is impressive in my opinion, you know. So anyway, back to divinities. Let's see, relationships are actually relationships. You have to work on a positive relationship. You have to talk to them, listen to them. They're not caricatures, study their mythology. Okay, believing the UPG you get about them. Sorry, we're going through the notes here. UPG is unverified personal gnosis. It's the inspirations that you get about things that, while to you they're true and they make sense and they fit into your worldview, you can't verify with any research that you have, so it becomes unverified. And it's possible that other people don't have the same experiences, so it's not something that they can confirm or deny, so it's personal. That's the definition of UPG.
For an example, there was an example given in some book that I read ages ago, that Freya liked strawberries. Now, as far as I know, strawberries aren't mentioned in any of the Norse lore, so technically it's unverified, but the person who worked with Freya had that UPG that, you know, an offering of strawberries was a good thing. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And there's many UPGs like that. Like, one of the things that I came up with personally when I was doing work with Rhiannon of the Birds is that in her mythology, one of the things that happens is she is sentenced to be a pony for 7 years because supposedly she ate her child. Okay, now this is not true. She was a good mother. She was a good queen. But because she was sentenced to this and the king couldn't do anything about it, she had to endure this sentence for 7 years. Well, it came to me while I was working with her and talking to her that that also gives her an aspect of a goddess of perseverance and endurance and being able to stand something that is killing you inside, even though you didn't do it, or maybe you did do it, you know. So that gives her another quality. And I found nothing in any of her mythology other than that story that says that. And here's another good example. I found no information in her mythology anywhere that associates her with birds at all, except for a couple of other stories where they say Rhiannon of the Birds and the Birds of Rhiannon. And there's no connection there, but everybody accepts it, you know. Anyway, but these are the kinds of UPGs that you need to pay attention to, because this is the deity saying, okay, you've been working with me for a while. I'm going to reveal a little bit more of my nature to you, show you something that is part of me. It's not something a lot of people know. It's not something a lot of people understand. And this is when you know instinctively that you're getting a deeper relationship with these deities that you're working with, okay? Another example of that is an example that I'm going to pull shamelessly from Mercedes Lackey. It's one of her books in the there's a trilogy in Valdemar where there's a Karasite priest who's gone to Valdemar, and he's being educated in his deity's mythos by a servitor of his deity, a fire cat who can think, who can communicate telepathically with him. If you've read the series, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't, that's a pretty good thumbnail to allow you to find it. But anyway, the cat is giving him, this young priest, an example. You have a warrior who goes out and has been going through many, many battles. He was a mercenary. He's fought all over the country. He's made a name for himself, and he's gotten very rich, and he's decided to retire. Okay, but because of how intemperate he was while he was young, he's decided that while living in the town, he's going to donate money of his to charity. But because he doesn't want the people of the town, you know, praising him for his generosity and his kindness and everything like that, he just sends his butler out with sacks of money to give to random people on the street over the course of an evening. And he does this once a week, okay? And this is, you know, his remorse about how being the hothead he was when he was younger, and so he's trying to help make everybody's life better, okay? He does this for years. Time passes. The general attitude of the poor and the impoverished is lifted. Things are getting better for everybody. And one day he's walking down a street, and he sees a woman getting attacked by a man, by another guy. So he whips out his sword. He goes and jumps to her defense and kills the guy. Well, it turns out that the guy was an old enemy of his that he hasn't seen in years, lost track of, doesn't know who he is, and, you know, he's killed him in a very violent, messy way. And all of these people now see him as a violent, vengeful man, because he, you know, jumped on an enemy of his and killed him without even a second thought, okay? They talk about that, and that's what they're focused on. That's how the people of the city know him, as a vengeful warrior, without ever knowing that what truly makes him is these years of acts of charity that he's been doing to make their life better, and not understanding that. UPG is like that. UPG is the deity going, okay, here's something that I've been having in my life, in my existence, that you need to know about so you can relate to me better, so that you understand more about me. And that's why it's so important when you pay attention to those. Okay? Make sense?
Yes, it does.
It's also a chance to get a better relationship with them. Deities come to us because we need something that is part of them, okay? They have things that they're supposed to teach us. They have aspects that they show to the world mostly to get you interested, okay? They do come and go, but mostly they will teach us what we need to know and what we can learn from them. And as they get to know us, because they're learning us too, they will realize, okay, this aspect of me that is important for this person to realize and to understand and to grow through, they're not going to be able to learn effectively from me. So let me get Yoda over here to yell at them and pound them on the head with a stick to get them to do what they need to do. And you know, sometimes that's what it takes, and that's what deities do. They will introduce you to other deities that you need to learn something from, and they will fade into the – and they might leave your life forever, and that's okay. Because there's times when you move across the ocean and you only talk to your mom and dad via email once a year at Christmas, and that's it. And that's okay. You know, it happens. It's not a permanent relationship. You're not giving up everything that you are for them. Okay? One other thing that's really important to understand when you're working with divinities is if you become known as a person who does work with this being, this deity, then you become a reflection of that divinity on the earth. And what you do in your life reflects upon them. Okay? Just like being a priest or a priestess, it's you just moving about in your life shows other people what your deities are like, okay? Because you become a representative. I mean, think about the worst televangelist you can possibly think of, the one that is the most hateful, the one that is the most bigoted, the one that – Fred Phelps, okay? Everybody knows Fred Phelps. And think about – what your reaction is when you hear his name, okay? Instant hate, anger, disagreement. Even if he said the sky was blue, you'd go running outside and scream that it was purple because it can't be blue because he lies all the time, okay? Well, think about what kind of reflection he is upon his deity. He is preaching that his God hates people simply because they are them, okay? So his deity is about hatred and bigotry and anger and hellfire and damnation. And everybody's going to hell. I don't care who they are. Nobody's redeemable. We're just going to get rid of all of you, okay? He is a reflection on that deity. And when he says that that is the God of the Bible, you've got every single other Christian out there who also believe in a deity of the Bible screaming, that's not my God, but it is. And yet at the same time, it isn't. Okay? Different aspects of the same deity.
That's true.
You got to keep this in mind. You got to keep in mind that your actions reflect on your deity as well. Okay? And part of your job is to be a decent vessel of them to everyone else, okay? You're not supposed to proselytize. You're not supposed to go out and go, hey, you must worship this God or else I'll kill you. But act your life as though your deity is with you all the time. And do your best to be a good reflection on them. Okay, and when asked, don't deny it. Don't say, no, I don't. I worship the god and goddess. Say, I worship Kali. And, you know, if you're kind-hearted, you know, maybe they'll start gentling the attitude of Kali as being an insane murderess into something that's a little bit better, okay? Something that extreme is going to take a little while. I mean, the concept of the Morrigan as a mother blew my mind when I read it, but apparently she did have a child, and part of the stick up her ass is the fact that he got killed. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it's you know, once more, study the mythology. Let me see. Let me talk about the seeking of a deity. Okay, when you're a new pagan, and especially when you're a baby Wiccan, a baby witch, there seems to be this attitude of you must find a deity, patron, matron, god and goddess immediately or else. Okay, and I've never, ever had anybody successfully explain to me what the or else was. All right? You do not, let me stress this again, you do not have to have a personal deity, god or goddess or neither, until you find them, okay? It is one of the big myths of paganism, and while next week's show is going to be on the myths of paganism and busting those myths, this one's important enough that we need to talk about it tonight, okay? You can use your group's default deities, okay? I know of a multitude of Wiccan groups that have this unspoken understanding. You have the group divinity, okay? You have the coven, excuse me, you have the coven group who pray to Woden and Freya, let's just say, for whatever reason, because I'm pulling from Sayax Wiccan tradition, okay? Sayax Wiccan tradition says the deities of Sayax Wicca are Woden and Freya, okay? An alternate name for Odin, and one of the female fertility mothers of Norse mythology, Freya, cried tears of gold, responsible for the fertility of the earth, okay?
She's also the one who wore the necklace that a lot of gardenarians get.
Exactly. And that's where I think the association came in, because Buckland, who created Sayax Wicca, was from gardenarian Wicca. And to remain true to his oaths, when he came up with Sayax Wicca, he imported very, very little from gardenarian, as far as I can understand, but he made a very, very complete, in my opinion, tradition that you can pick up the book and one book and I'm a witch type thing.
That's true.
It's one of the Since I mentioned it?
Well, a book recommendation for newbies or curious folks who want to learn about Sayax Wicca or just Wicca in general is
Big Blue Book. The tradition is that the book is referred to as the Big Blue Book. That's not the name. It's Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft. It's approximately 250, 300 pages long, and it's like a textbook. And literally it is. In discussions with Raymond at several points, he told me that essentially what he did was he took the seminary material from the Sayax Wiccan seminary, removed the tradition-specific stuff from that, the stuff that you'll find in the tree, rewrote a few parts of it for general rituals, and publish that as the Big Blue Book.
Yes. Highly recommended if you're new to Wicca or paganism in general. Full of information, and it breaks it all down into lessons.
And it's exceedingly good. And one of the things that people seem to not get about that book is they think that he's intentionally trying to make it a one book and I'm a witch thing. He's not. Okay? He states it very specifically in there that if you read this book and everything that he references, that you'll have knowledge equivalent to a third degree priestess in most other traditions. Okay? What they focus on is if you read this book, knowledge, third degree priestess. What they miss is, and everything referenced. And believe me, I sat down and counted at one point. He references 180 other works, from Gardner's writings to the Golden Bough to mythological works. Classics of paganism.
And
these are not light reads. And you have to read all of those as well. And that's one of the big things, too.
The fact that he refers to other books, you know, by other publishers and stuff, it's not like he's trying to specifically focus on a particular publisher. He refers to other books, you know, and you can find various publishers and editions of each of those, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And then there's also the knowledge equivalent to. He's not saying that reading all of this will make you a third degree priestess in Gardnerian Wicca. What he's saying is that you will have the knowledge that a third degree priestess should have.
It's very true. At any rate, enough of our promotion of Buckland's book.
Yeah, it's a really good book. If you've never encountered it, it's what started me on this path. I mean, I had been doing things with telepathy and psychokinesis and UFOs and the pyramids and Bigfoot and the writings of some of the Blavatsky and other mystics and, you know, some of the stuff that Levi wrote. So I had a lot of scattered knowledge. When I actually started into Wicca specifically, I started with the Big Blue Book. And what he did was he took all this knowledge that I had scattered around, things on stones and psychic abilities and projecting energy with your hands, and he organized it for me and put it in and codified it and went, okay, here's this, here's this, here's this. And so I kind of came into it backwards. I read all the reference works first, and then I read the workbook.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made more sense that way.
Okay. Mind you, I mean, when I started out, too, there were only, like, a handful of books. I mean, because I was picking up the kind of leftovers from the 80s and early 90s when I first started. And the Big Blue Book was one of those. And, you know, I mean, obviously, things by Dion Fortune and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, pick a name and, you know, I probably discovered it at some point because
Casey.
Actually, I was fascinated by him for a while. Yeah. He was one of those weird random authors that I was just like, hey, this guy's kind of cool.
I wound up doing more with like Seth and those books, listening, not so much Casey. He seemed a little bit too
Christian,
esoteric at the time. Well, no, esoteric is a good word. I mean, you're talking about somebody that's 10 years old reading a book about channeling spirits and how the universe is organized. And my brain couldn't comprehend that at the time. It was,
that's
you know,
true.
Oh, okay.
So there was a lot of it that, yeah. There was a lot of the classic stuff, like the hard classics that if you were too young when you started, you wouldn't get out of them as much as you could.
Mm-hmm. Years later, you've got something and you're reading something and suddenly what you read back then drops into place and you go, oh, and you get, UPG.
That's true. Or you kind of go, hey, wait, I remember reading that in that book. And then you're going, I'm going to reread that book because I probably will get way more out of it now.
Or you go, wait a minute, I've encountered this concept before. Where was that? What was that book? What was the name? Oh, shit. And you spend the next year racking your brains trying to figure out where you read it before.
This is true.
Because that happens to me constantly.
Yeah, I mean, if you read enough of the old reference works, I mean, you'll find yourself in that same situation all the time whenever you hear some minute reference in a book by some new author, and you'll be like, wait a minute, I know that's an older idea than this person's claiming it is, because I read it in author from the 19th century, or what have you.
Like the concept of duality, where you have evil and you have good. And a lot of people seem to have this misconception that it originated with Christianity, and it just didn't. They stole it from Zoroastrianism, and they stole it from somebody else, and they stole it from somebody else. So,
well, I imagine that a lot of that originates with the ancient Egyptian pantheon too, because a lot of the Western mysticism that's been handed down over the centuries has come out of Egypt and has been westernized, via Christianity and Judaism, etc.
Tends to have been. I don't know, that's a whole nother topic and something that probably we could spend several hours on. And we'd have to get people in smarter than me, because that's not something that I can, I'm that knowledgeable about. It's been a long time. Okay.
Riff mentally.
Yeah, not really.
Let's see. So what about the times when your gods kind of act stubbornly and, they throw tantrums, or they kind of need to be reined in?
All right. Well, one of the things that you're going to have as a priest or priestess, or somebody that works with the gods constantly, is you're going to realize that these divinities are not perfect. They are people. They are children sometimes. They are spoiled teenage brats at other times. They are wise old people sitting up on the mountaintop dispensing wisdom like you would think the hermit does. They encapsulate every aspect of humanity in themselves, because if the school of thought that humans created the gods through their need is accurate, then you have every aspect of a human in the deities. Can't get away with that. You are going to have people who are, or deities that are selfish. You're going to have deities who are childish. You're going to have ones that are arrogant, because all of that's part of humanity. You can't get away with it. I always looked at the Roman gods and the Greek gods and went, what a bunch of children. Well, they can't help it.
That's part of the appeal of the Greco-Roman pantheons, too, is the fact that they are so human. And obviously, the fact that most people are introduced to them first. But when you read the mythology for Greek gods, they are very human. It's like they have all this cosmic power and, this amazing super deific power. But it's tainted with this very human kind of pettiness or jealousy or et cetera, et cetera. I mean, insert human emotion here and, you know, you've got gods who experience or who display that very emotion in their mythology. And, you know, I mean, depending too on the pantheon, there will be versions of stories that, you know, like one mention of, say, Zeus will focus on his particular noble aspects, whereas there will be some aspects that are like, and here's where he was this arrogant, you know, bastard who went and just screwed around with any woman that came along, and he just disavowed, you know, completely ignored his wife and all this kind of thing. You know, and it's just like every pantheon has versions of stories that tell different aspects of each god.
Perfect example of that is the story of Arachne and Athena. I mean, here you have a deity who is touted as wisdom in combat, somebody who is gentle, intelligent, reasoned, thoughtful, who also happens to be the patron of artisans, okay, which you need patience for. And somebody said that some human-made stuff as good as Athena does, and so she goes down there and goes, you are going to be, I am challenging you. And then not only gets beaten, but then slaps her in the head to make her feel bad because she beat this goddess. And then when she goes out and kills herself, then the goddess feels bad and turns her into a spider. It's like, what the fuck?
It's true.
Phenomenal.
It is very
power.
True. Easy, itty bitty living space.
Well, not just that, but the itty bitty temper.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the thing, though, with the Greek gods, and that's why I loved them when I was a kid. I mean, Apollo was one of my favorite deities as, you know, growing up, and, you know, he still is. I mean, I've got a statue of him sitting on a shelf in my room.
I've got a temple to Athena just walking distance from my house.
Really? See,
really?
I don't have temples nearby.
Well, they, for some reason, when Nashville, the city that I live in, was being built, one of the people came back from Greece and was so impressed by the Parthenon there that they recreated it here. And it's a heck of a big tourist attraction. It's absolutely gorgeous. I saw part of it, and the main temple where the seat of Athena is beautiful. Unfortunately, you have to pay money to get in there, but I would think that it would be worth it. I just haven't been able to get over there. I mean, because it's down the street. Why would I want to go to it until I need to?
And, I mean, if you want to justify the cost of going into a place like that, I mean, consider an offering to the deity in question. I mean, if you have to pay to go to the Parthenon, I don't know, I've never been, you know, consider it an offering and or as an opportunity to interact with deities. You know, if you have to pay some money to hit Delphi, consider an offering to Apollo and, you know, ask for his blessings.
Oh, yeah. And that's one of the things about deities that when you start interacting with them, you're going to understand they're going to test you sometimes. They're going to go, look, you want to talk to me? Show me that you mean it, you know. Make me something or do this or do this service or go here or pay this money or get this jewelry and bury it outside because I like it, you know. And there's going to be times when they're going to do that and they're just going to, you know, go, na, 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 I don't want to talk to you until you do this. And you're going to have to understand that there's going to be times when you need to do that because there's reasons. And to use a Tumblrism, reasons, okay? It's not
necessarily... Why are you doing this? For reasons.
For reasons. And you don't always know all of the reasons. You don't always understand what's going on. But you have to understand that the deities and the spirits that you're working with have access to a shit fuck ton, metric fuck ton more of information than you do, okay? And there are going to be a reason for it. Now, the reasons can be as simple as I want you to do it and I want to test your follow-through, test your ability to follow instructions. I want to see if you're serious about this, serious enough to harm yourself and your family because this is serious. And there could be times when it's as simple as, well, I want you to. And it could be as simple sometimes as seeing if you'll say no. Because they do these things. They play these mental games. Okay? They know what's going on. They know what's going on in your life. They know what's going on in their life. They understand what's going on around them. Okay? And they'll give you instructions that are weird like that. Sometimes to test your resolve, and sometimes to test if you're willing to take the next step and go, you've asked for something that I absolutely cannot give you. I want to give it to you. I need to give it to you. I want to do it, but I can't for one reason or another. And to see if you have the courage to stand up to them and say, I can't, or no, or whatever. Okay.
Or they'll, so, you know, conversely, they'll test you to test your resolve to see if you're willing to, like, make the effort to make it happen, you know, on their behalf, because, like, they may want you to go to Delphi or, you know, to some random temple in, like, Saudi Arabia or something, and in your mind you're like, there's no way I can make it, or there's no way this can happen, but, you know, that may be something that it's like on your heart, to speak in Christian terms, to do this, because somehow you have the impression that that's going to improve the relationship and there's no getting around it. So they may be testing your willingness to, like, scrimp and save and sacrifice the you know, the comforts of, like, the daily coffee that you desperately need before you start work. You know, are you willing to cut that out in order to put that money away for the trip, et cetera? Like,
And there's going to be times when they'll say something like that and they'll demand something, and they're willing to negotiate. I mean, saying that you have to make the trip to the actual Thanon in Greece and worship her there is great and it's wonderful, but if you absolutely can't get the passport, if the authorities are not willing to let you get there or go there, or you can't travel there because of terroristic threats or something like that, she may be willing to listen to you going to the Parthenon here, you know, and
true.
So understand that these are negotiable at times. One sacrifice that I had in a ritual that I put together to bring me a job one time was I was calling upon Lou Samovanich and Talshu. I had written a big article about Talshu. I had put it up on my website. I burnt a copy of it to her so that, you know, as this is a service that I did for her to bring more people to knowing her, so possibly, you know, some she would get some followers. But Lou has a spear that burns all the time. They can't put it out. He can't put it any place because it starts fires. So he keeps the head of it in a cauldron of blood to keep the fire quenched until he pulls it out to use it. So I dedicated a blood donation cross to him you know, saying, here is blood taken out of my vein. Use it to quench your spear for a little while, you know. And, yeah, they don't, you know, want the actual physical squirted all over the ground because that's gross, you know. Let somebody else have the actual physical plasma and platelets and everything because they may need it for a life-saving transfusion. But the essence of the sacrifice still goes to them, to the deities, okay? You're taking the spirituality, the etheric component, as some would say, and lifting that off of the actual physical quarter blood and giving the etheric component to the deities, okay? A huge feast that you lay out for the deities on their day, they're not going to eat. They can't come down, manifest physically, and devour all the food. I mean, they just can't. They may take shape in a bird and eat some of it. They may manifest themselves in an avatar of a person and come and have some of it, okay? But that's it. I mean, this huge feast is not going to be consumed by them, but they do consume the essence of that feast. And that leaves all the physical food, which the celebrants can partake in, which can be donated to the homeless, which can be scattered out into the woods and into nature where the creatures of nature and the plants will partake in it because it goes right back to them, you know, and that's something as well, you know. So sacrifice, and sometimes these things that they demand are not quite so out there. And there's going to be times when, oh, God, there's a concept that is on many pagan forums these days of a god spouse, okay? This is literally somebody that is married to a deity, okay? If you want to think of it in this way, think of a nun. A Catholic nun. A Catholic nun is literally married to Jesus. Okay? That's close to what this concept of a god spouse is. Okay? But because they're married to this deity, the deity is there constantly, always in their face. Okay? And they can get really damn irritating. All right? They may, you know, demand something at some point where they wait. Okay, I know that I've mentioned this before. They may wake you up at 3 in the morning and say, get into full ritual regalia, go out to this park. And you're going, what the fuck? And they're, just do it. And so you get into full ritual regalia, you go out to the park and you stand there for an hour, you start feeling silly and you go home. Well, there's always a reason for something like this. And while it could just be to test you to see how serious you are, it could be that your presence there with all your magical items and all your consecrated tools prevented something from manifesting or could have sealed a breach simply with your presence that prevented something else from coming through, okay? So there's going to be times that stuff like this happens, and it's something that you just got to live with, okay? And it happens to me all a lot. It used to happen a lot more. These days, if something like that comes up, then, you know, usually I'm going with them on the astral to take care of it. And that's when you got to trust that they've got access to more knowledge and more of the understanding than you do, okay? One of my favorite ways of explaining not only the astral plane, but to put it into Doctor Who terms, the big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff, is think of a tapestry, okay? A giant tapestry that's up on the wall, okay? I don't care what you imagine the pictures are. It's a big rug, okay, to keep out the drafts. Looking at it, when you're standing away from it, you can see the patterns that it makes. you can see the creatures that are moving here and doing this, and you can see this one that's stabbing the other, and it's down, and they're standing on the dragon, and this person is happy, and that person is not. And you can see the picture, okay? But when you get up right on top of it and you get a microscope, you see one fiber of one thread that may be fraying at one section and may be dirty at another and may have this little drop of dye on this microscopic fraction. And then it has this piece of pollen on another part, okay? And this is how the astral plane, this is how everything works. You, as you live and as you breathe, with the understanding that you have in this time and space, are right up on top of that tapestry. And you can see where the threads are frayed, where the dye is, where the pollen is. It's not until you die and you ascend that you pull back and you can see the overall pattern, or even more of the pattern. And this is how the deities see things. They're pulled very far back. They can see the entire tapestry. They can see the patterns. They may not be able to see the details section, but they can zoom in to the point where they're seeing through your eyes that one piece of pollen. And they know that one piece of pollen needs to go because it's affecting threads that are next to it, which are affecting this part of the tapestry. And so they tell you to remove that piece of pollen, and you're going, what the hell? It's a piece of pollen. It's not going to hurt anything. And they just say, do it, because they don't have time or the words or the concepts to be able to explain, well, when I'm pulled way back and I'm looking at the overall tapestry, that piece of pollen is corrupting this and that and the other, and it's affecting all these other threads around it, which is affecting this section of the pattern.
Fair enough.
Sorry, I'm doing all the talking tonight and my mouth is drying out.
Free to go get a glass of water if you want.
Well, understand, to you guys that are listening, I work on the astral plane all the time, okay? I work every night. I'm out doing something. Like I said, there's like 16 different dragons that are a presence in my life. I got introduced to them about 8 years ago through a little dragon that just decided to show up one day. For a child that I take care of on the astral. And I had asked for a being to help me take care of this child, to protect this child, to love this child like I could when I couldn't be there because I was awake and walking around and doing mundane things. This little dragon showed up, looked a little like a fire lizard from Anne McCaffrey, and through this little dragon, I got introduced to a half-dragon, half-cat hybrid who took me as hers and then introduced me to a number of major dragons all over the world and eventually introduced me to Lord Fuji, as in the mountain that grew up around the Earth dragon that was laying there because he was just didn't move. And his entire court, and the Earth Dragon of Earth Dragons, and so they're a big part of my life these days. So all of this, you know, that I'm talking about experience. This is not UPG. This is not stuff that I read out of the book. This is not other people's experiences. This is stuff that I actually lived, and stuff that actually happened to me. It's a very long, complex, complicated story. I can go into the details, but it would take several days to relate, and I'm not joking about that. That's how complex all of this is, because through the dragons, I've met the Kitsune. Through the Kitsune, I've met other species of beings out there. I have created thought forms. I have had better experience with spells. I stopped Syria from gassing its own people. Okay, this is the kind of stuff that happens, and it's a interconnectedness that is ridiculous until you get to the macro level and start looking at the overall tapestry. Okay, one way that you can do that is with astral projection. Okay, being able to leave your body severs your connection to the here and now. It kind of takes you out of time. One of the things that is mentioned several times when you're dealing with Wicca is a time that's not a time and a place that's not a place. That's echoed in Jonathan Livingston Seagull, where he's ascending and mentions to one of his friends that if all times are here, and all, or if all times are now and all places are here, then we're going to bump into each other in the here and now eventually. But if we go to all this trouble to understand that there's more to life than what we know right this minute so that we can ascend, then we're destroying our own brotherhood and we're destroying our own friendship. And that's stupid. So there's one of two things that either happens. Either you stay where you are and don't ascend, which kind of defeats the purpose of trying to ascend, or you understand that what's here and now is not all that there is. And when I understood that concept, my brain went boof. And it was like, wow, that's profound. And more than that, that's what's right. And that's one of the things that really gave me the key to understanding more of the tapestry, pull back further than I normally can and see a bit more than just the thread, the fiber that I'm on, to understanding some of why these things are occurring. A good instance of that is this podcast, okay? I like to talk. I don't know if anybody out there has twigged to this fact or not. I enjoy teaching. I like explaining things. But I also understand that even if these podcasts do nothing right this minute or next week or next month or next year, eventually somebody is going to hear these podcasts and their mind is going to expand, and they are going to be somebody that is on the level of Gandhi, on the level of Alphys Levi, on the level of whoever the author of the Emerald Tablet was, and be able to make more direct changes to their life and everybody else's lives at the same time, okay? So in that, these podcasts are important simply because of the potential that they have. All right, and I understand that from having looked further on the timeline, okay? And there's chances that they get lost. So I'm trying real hard to make sure that I keep them in multiple places, not only on Blog Talk, but on our website. I've got copies on my hard drive. I'm sure Brian's got copies on his. Eventually we'll wind up making them available in different formats. They might even get passed around as CDs at some point. And people will be going, oh, wow, this is ancient technology. But, you know, they'll stay out there, and they'll keep coming back. And somebody someday will hear it, and it will help them. And it may be that they just advance themselves, and they don't become a dictator like Hitler because this helps them at that point in time, all right?
Or conversely, they do. The garbled recording is unclear. And
yeah,
sorry, I'm
something.
Thinking of 12 monkeys now. But anyway, I was just thinking, the situation, the whole idea of interacting with deities and the fact that they possess more knowledge, experience, and power and all this kind of stuff. Now, in certain pagan traditions, there's this idea that you have to be initiated into a tradition by someone who's already following it, who's been initiated, etc. And the chain goes on forever until the first person who was initiated somehow by boogeyman or, you know, somebody. Do the gods have some means or power to initiate someone who's interacting with them directly?
Well, personally, it is my considered opinion from all this interaction that the gods initiate people directly themselves. Okay. The classic question, which came first, the first witch or the initiate, you know, is another one of those conundrums. In order to be a witch, you have to have a witch to initiate you, and that's true. But here's a difference. There's dedication and there's initiation. Initiation, by definition, you have to have somebody else do to you, okay? A dedication is you saying that I serve fill in the blank at this point, whatever divinity it is, okay? And then through that process of the dedication and your interaction with that deity and the UPG and the listening to them and the praying to them and the working with them and the hearing from them, you get the keys to the mysteries that are necessary for you to pass on to anybody that you're teaching. Ergo, the deities have initiated you through a long process, and you now have the tools necessary to initiate others into those same mysteries. Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about understanding not only spells, but how to improve ourselves, how to improve our life, how to become better people, understanding more of our little section of the tapestry than just what we can see, okay? And in order to do that, there's a lot of work that you have to do on a spiritual level, all right? In an initiation, when you are going through it with a group, one of the things that happens is you get put into a heightened state of awareness. And we talked about this last week in episode 2 with the rituals, which is called a consciousness shift. Your brain throws itself out of the mundane everyday life and goes into kind of a high gear where you're more aware of things around you. And it's easier at that point to cause changes, to rearrange little blocks inside a brain so that it makes a different pattern, okay? In a ritual initiation like that, that's what you're doing. You're going in and you're causing the consciousness shift, and then you are directly teaching these specific mysteries to the initiate to cause the change to start happening in them almost immediately, okay? You can get to the same place simply by working on it yourself with the deities, because they're going to cause those changes in you. They're going to rearrange the little blocks. But because you're not in a heightened state of awareness, because you don't have that consciousness shift, it's going to take a longer time, all right? So deities initiate you. It may take you a decade or two or three, but it's going to happen. And you will recognize when you are their person, their boy, their girl, their priest or priestess, because they will say, now, you have these keys. Go and share these keys with others. Okay? So that's something else. And, I mean, and there's also times when they're going to go, okay, I've taught you everything that I possibly can. here's another god who knows more than I do on this subject. Listen to them. Or, you and I are too similar in attitude. I have this thing that I've been working on, and you have this thing that you've been working on, and I can't teach you how to overcome it because I don't know either. However, this god over here, grab, yank, is the person that is helping me. They're going to help you now. Go. And they're going to, you know, tag out, essentially, and let other deities do things for them, simply because it's easier. I mean, I could build a suit of armor if I really wanted to, but it would be easier for me to go to one of my friends in the SCA who's a metal forger and say, this is what I want, here's a lot of money, let me have it. Because they've already gone through all of the experience and learning process to do it. They've made all the mistakes.
It's true, yeah. I mean, it's a very sensible thing to refer someone if you don't have the experience to do a particular thing.
And so now, if we do that here, why wouldn't the gods do it on their level?
Well, exactly.
I mean, as you know, as the Emerald Tablet says, as above, so below. Well, the converse is true as well. As below, so above. If we do it here, it's reasonable to think that the gods are going to do it too, which means that they also will eventually leave you, and that's okay, which I already mentioned.
Now, speaking in more Wiccan terms, if people are familiar with Wicca, there was something that was really popular in the 80s, especially when I started sort of exploring paganism, that, you know, there was a very strong focus on the goddess. Now, what if, as a seeker, you're working or attempting to work with the so-called balance between the god and goddess, and you find that rather than a strong connection with the goddess, that you are more directly connected to the god. Is that a bad thing? Is there a problem with that? You know, because there's a lot of criticism, you know, with focusing on the male aspect of deity if you're Wiccan, because somehow that's not correct. But do you see that as a problem?
Personally, no. I mean, it's like, do you like your mother, or do you feel closer to your mother or your father? It depends on your personality. It depends on you. The whole stink about focusing solely on the goddess in the beginning was a reaction to Christianity. Okay, in Christianity you have a singular male deity who, if you read his words literally in the Old Testament, is really misogynistic, a jerk, dislikes babies, tells his followers to kill everybody of different religions simply because they're there. Okay. Very war-like tribal deity. So you have a religion that's just developing that has a goddess who's gentle and kind and nice and who's a mom, okay, rather than this stern father figure that you've been told about all this time. So now you have a whole religion that starts coming in with a female divinity and minimizes the male divinity as a reaction to having grown up Christian. Because let's face it, in Western society, the default religion is Christianity. Okay? You can't really get away with it. They're the most successful religion there is on the face of the earth at this point. I mean, you've got 7 billion people on the planet, and at this point, 2.7 billion are Christian. Okay? You can't get away with it. So it's most likely that in a Western civilization, and I'm talking Europe, England, Americas, Canada, all those, that you were raised in some form of Christianity to start with, okay, which means that you got the stern, loving God who is your father in heaven, who loves you, who punishes you, who is going to throw you into the pit of hell if you misbehave, who you give all credit to when you do something right, and who you take all the blame from when something goes wrong, okay? And then you get into Wicca or some form of paganism, and you find out that it's not your fault anymore, that there's a mother deity who loves you simply for being you, the Mr. Rogers syndrome. I love you because you are alive. You are a person. You have existence. You are important. You are special, okay? And that's what the deity, what the goddess is telling you. I mean, that's simply, that's it, isn't it? I mean, that's what you got when you first started, right?
Well, I don't know. I guess in my experience, in the early days, because I was reading the what is typically now known as Dianic witchcraft sort of books, as a guy, I was getting the impression of, you know, it's terribly, terribly wrong of me to, you know, have any desire to relate to a male deity because just by associating myself with that, I was connecting to insert misogynistic historical event here just by association. And it, to me, that felt very condescending, judgmental, almost kind of a reactionary reverse in a tradition of goddess monotheism, basically. I mean, there was always that nod to, oh, well, yeah, she's got the male sun consort, you know, there, but he's just kind of sort of a passing thought. You know, he just exists for the sake, like drones do for bees. He's there to breed, and then he dies and does his own thing and praise the goddess and nobody else, kind of thing. And that was my introduction to witchcraft and to the god and goddess.
Well, here you go. You said it in the very beginning. You were reading the Dianic Wiccan, okay? The Dianic Wicca stuff was done by Z. Budapest, who is, in my opinion, while she was an extremely good elder and deserves all the credit for helping bring paganism and Wicca and witchcraft to mainstream, the reactionary, feministic crap that is still with us because of all of that needs to go away, okay? The Dianic stuff, I don't know. Okay, and now I'm speaking to the listeners. If you don't know anything about Dionysism, there's two groups. One is extremely reactionary, the second generation feminist line, okay, where women can do no wrong and everything that is wrong with society is the man's fault, and we need to put them in internment camps and use them as blood-filled dildos, and that's it. And they
it's
came
true.
Up with...
And actually, go ahead.
No, you go. Go.
Well, I mean, like the books that I started out with were either kind of a recovering Christian viewpoint, i.e., like Sybil Leek and predominantly Sybil Leek. whose books I quite enjoyed. You know, I mean, I started reading them when I was 13 or whatever. But then, you know, I encountered authors like Starhawk and Margot Adler and on like that. And, you know, documentaries like one called The Burning Times, which was made by National Film Board of Canada. And they were all talking, you know, to feminist authors who somehow made it seem that you could not be a witch unless you were specifically goddess-oriented. And it was only later into the 80s and early 90s that I started discovering any authors who said, well, you know, aside from that reactionary feminist monotheism kind of thing, there's also the concept that deity is both male and female, and each has an equal and important part in the whole concept. Mm-hmm. Kitty, no.
That said, yeah, that's the way it should. It was. I mean, you had the monotheistic juggernaut of Christianity that overran just about everybody. And it wasn't until, and then when paganism and Wicca specifically started becoming mainstream in the 70s and early 80s, it was a very reactionary, because also, you know, ERA was coming in, second wave feminism was coming in. All of that was happening at the same time. Drug, sex, rock and roll, free love, you know, enjoying your body because you enjoy it instead of being a prude about it. All that was happening right around the same time. So it was an extreme anti-reaction with pulling back from a monotheistic male deity to a monotheistic female deity who also had a guy in her life that she screwed when she was horny. And that was it. And the concept at the time was a necessary one. I think current events have passed it by. And as we saw in the late 80s, early 90s, we started getting into a more balanced viewpoint. Because, I mean, to be honest, I never understood the monotheistic male deity. Just simple observation looking around. 51% of the population is not male. So how can you have just a male deity? Well, on the other side, how can you have just a female deity?
And,
go ahead.
I mean, the interesting thing is, too, that when you're dealing with the concept of monotheism, you're actually – what you're getting is kind of a specialized viewpoint on the world, because if you look into Kabbalistic interpretations of God, the idea isn't strictly like monotheistic male deity. God is three parts in the sense that God is Keter, Chokmah, and Binah in the Tree of Life, and those three spheres represent the active, passive, and neutral concepts, I guess you could say. They're like they're the heating, the energetic heating concept, the energetic cooling concept, and then kind of the neutral state between them. I kind of want to say, you know, like flowing water versus ice versus steam, you know, the basic idea being that deity is three parts in one, only because there's like the father, the mother, and the child.
And that's where I think some of it got screwed up, because, and for this I lay the blame totally at Robert Graves' doorstep with the triple deity. Because having a triple deity, father, mother, child, makes more sense to me than just looking at maiden, mother, crone.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's entirely sensible, because then you get this kind of weird concept of the duality of deity branching off from the source, the ultimate is, as you referred to it earlier, into male and female, and then from each of those you get three faces, you know, maiden, mother, crone, kind of like youth, father, elder kind of deal for the male. And then you get this whole branching down thing where it becomes like a multitude of deities off of the simple concept of father, mother, and child. Which, I mean, I suppose it's useful if you want to see the world that way, but at the same time, I mean, polytheism gives you the option of relating to any of hundreds, thousands, millions of gods who you might relate better in certain aspects without ascribing that triune concept. You know, like, it may not work for you. If you study the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, Krishna is seen as sort of an androgyne figure, as a face of God, the supreme creator, whereas other traditions of Krishna talk about him and Radha as the male and female balance. And, you know, you've got like Shiva and Parvati who give birth to Ganesh, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, like, there's ways to see gods that, you know, break it down into what is very logically, you know, two or three aspects instead of only one.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. If that is what floats your boat, that's great. In worshiping a divinity, in dealing with divinities, you can't really do it wrong. The guidelines are this. Treat each of them as people, because ultimately that's what they are. One of the concepts that came out of Mormonism is that as you are now, I once was, as I am now, you may become. And that boils down to the gods are an advanced version of us. They've lived longer, they understand more, they've seen more, they have more experience, they're immortal, and they're living in a higher plane of existence. But all they ultimately are is ascended humans. And humans have the ability, if you live long enough, if you experience enough, if you think enough, to ascend to that same level. Okay, and to become divinities themselves, and to be worshipped, and to be seen by other societies, and, you know, take care of them. So this is a concept that it's the ultimate recession and progression of yourself. It's another stage. So when dealing with divinities, treat them like your best friend. Treat them like your brother. Treat them like your sister, like your parents. Okay? However you would treat another person in your life that you respect, that you like being around, whose advice you seek out, treat them like that. Okay? And understand that they're going to have their emotions. They're going to have their off days. The goddess is going to have her period. The god is going to wake up at Samhain and want his coffee, you know, and going to be grumbly, and, you know, give them time and space, talk to them, and listen for them more than anything else. The one thing that I find absolutely mind-boggling with people who work with divinities is that they don't listen to them. Simple, quick prayer. You know, God has helped me. I don't know what to do here. Take 20, 30 seconds to shut up and listen for her advice. That Christianity has this thing about a still small voice that you will hear when you're quiet and you're looking inside that will tell you what to do. That's what you're listening for. And that doesn't matter if it comes from, if you feel it come from your heart, come from your head, from your gut, from the ethers around you, from your little toe, from your stuffed animal. It doesn't matter as long as you hear it and react to it.
And as long as that's not telling you to kill anyone, and well, if it does, you say no. You know, because if your little toe is telling you to kill someone, you might need to check into some place, then get some help.
Yeah. And more than anything, you know what you're making up. And if you know yourself, which is why every single mystical school of thought has some version of know thyself, you will understand what is coming from you, coming from your imagination, and what is actually coming from the spirits that you're interacting with, dealing with, and the divinities that you're talking to. Okay? You will be able to make that distinction. The gods are supposed to be your friends. They're supposed to be the most important thing in your life. Okay? They understand that you have your job here on Earth to do. And 99.99% of it is mundane, day-to-day, providing for your body crap, okay? But there's that one little bit that is not, and that's where the gods fit into, okay? And it's not hard to pull them into your life as a normal routine. You know, get up in the morning, put a picture on a wall where you're going to see it when you come downstairs, and say hi to the gods as you're walking out the door. You know, ask for their blessing when you get into the car and you're putting the key into it that you don't have an accident. All those things. Go ahead.
Sorry. The whole concept with a lot of mystical traditions is that you learn to become mindful of the divine that manifests within you or outside of you, however you choose to see it. Because I can think of traditions like Hinduism or Gnosticism that say, you know, the work that you need to do is to become mindful of the divine. So it is important that, you know, you do take the time in the course of your day-to-day routine, however that may be, unfold. And, you know, if you want to say grace or anything like that at meals, then to keep those things in mind as you're living life.
And I mean, I had a shrine at my desk at work that was all it was just a little picture of the goddess and a piece of antler. And I, you know, and that was enough that when I saw that, it was like a visual mnemonic that brought me into, okay, let me be mindful of the gods now. Let me understand that they're with me. And just feeling their presence for a second. Because I would get, you know, locked into trying to fix a computer. And, you know, it happens. You get focused on something, and you have to take a second or two, to realize that they are there, they are with you, and that they are, you know, imminent. The last thing that I want to say is the gods are supposed to be your friends. Okay, they are not scary. They are not mean. They are not out to get you. They are not out to judge you. But any time that you are working on level three, okay, remember the is and then yin and yang and then the deities? when you're working on level three, which is the named divinities, use their name. Remember that they are individuals, that they are people in and of themselves, and don't lump them together. It's only when you're trying to work on the yin and yang concept level, where you have a god and goddess, that it's okay to associate a warrior woman with a mother, with a surgeon female, with a lawyer female, with a hunter, and kind of squish all of them together. But also remember that there's that male aspect of them as well in the concept of yang. Okay, there is that little white circle in that big section of black. Okay, and so there are going to be male aspects in there, and you've got to acknowledge that. I'm pretty much out of everything that I want to say, so I guess it's time to talk about the credits. Brian and I are the ones that are doing this. We're doing it all on our own. We are using Blog Talk Radio as a means of bringing the podcast to you right now, although we are trying to get off of that. So this is where I mentioned that we have expenses. The website, the software to do the recordings and to store the recordings, and then there's, you know, various things like that to, you know, make sure that you can continue to hear this podcast. So ads, if you sell something and you want to take up some ad space with us, $10 a week, you'll get seen by people and you can hopefully get some sales off of that. It's not a heck of a lot because right now we don't have a lot of traffic, but hopefully that's going to change some. We also will mention you here on the show so that people 20 years from now will still hear about you and can go to your site. You know, so it's a pretty good deal. There's also a donation button on the webpage in case you don't have something that you're selling, but still feel that this is important enough that you want to give us $5, $10 or so to help us pay our bills. I have a website. It's aaronsjournal.com. That's my main website. My personal Tumblr, as Brian said at the beginning, is wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. And Brian's is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. We're on there quite a lot. We look forward to your emails, your calls, your questions, thoughts, anything that you want to share with us either on the website or through email, joy@magicalmusings.net and brian@magicalmusings.net are our email addresses. There are comments that are open for the various episodes, so that you can put a comment in there. We did a good job. Y'all stink. You were totally wrong on this concept. This was very intriguing. Anything like that.
Yeah, we do want to hear positive and negative feedback because we want to be able to improve the show. If you guys don't like something, we want to be, you know, aware of things that you do enjoy so that we can put in more of them or, you know, tweak them, whatever.
Most definitely.
And like Joy said, you know, if you guys have something to sell or you have a website that you want to get some advertising to, talk to us. You know, we want to put some ad space on various blogs and websites and, you know, audio ads into the show, so that we can, you know, create a relationship with sponsorship and, you know, our listeners. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Good show.
Have a good night,
have
folks.
Have a good evening. Bye.
Bye-bye.